Hello and welcome to the Simples edition of Romaniacs. It's our 100th podcast. We thought we'd take time out for a leisurely look at two important issues we haven't done in enough detail. The border in Ireland and the issue of Norway Plus, or Common Market 2.0. We booked two exceptionally well-informed guests. We're trying to make that happen. Exceptionally well-informed guests who we'll meet in a moment. On Monday, the Labour Party finally fell off the fence regarding a people's vote. Or did they? Theresa May finally caved on giving MPs a vote on no deal and a delay to Brexit. And at this very moment, Wednesday afternoon, there's a logjam of Brexit amendments that will determine the very future of the country, working their way through Parliament. Happy centenary to us. I'm Dorian Linsky and two of our regulars are with me. Hello to actor, comedian, writer, director and F5 refresh button presser when it comes to Brexit news, Ingrid Oliver.
Hello. How are you? Hi, Ingrid. I'm very well, thank you. It was my birthday this week. And all my presents were Brexit related. I've become like that kid when you're a child and you sound like owls, and then your grandmother every Christmas, every birthday, you just get owl. Owl brothers, owl pencil cases. For me, it's now Brexit. I'm wearing a necklace.
Brexit owl.
European.
Brexit very fetching.
My boyfriend.
What were the other Brexit gifts?
You know, books, mugs, tea towels.
Can you get a Brexit pencil case?
You can't yet. Gap in the market. Andrew is on it.
So you've been filming a romantic comedy called Last Christmas.
I have.
Presumably a Christmassy film.
No, it is.
So I just thought it was, it's a fake out. With Emma Thompson. Is everyone whipping out their phones between takes to catch up on the latest hot Brexit news?
Well, funny enough, the first day I walked on set, one of the crew came up to me and went, "Oh my God, you're in Romaniacs." And I was like, yes. And he's like, "Oh, I'm a massive fan." And it's like I've always said, Brexit is the new rock and roll. It was really weird. And actually, there was a Danish actor as well, who's brilliant. He was in Borgen. I don't know if anyone watched that. It's very good. And I was a big fan of his. And he was quite damning about the whole thing. He's like, "You guys, you're going crazy. What's going on? I think that's Dutch. Damn it, I did in Dutch. But
you're not there for the accent.
No.
That's very good.
So yeah, it was, and actually, I probably can't reveal too much because I can't be retrospectively fired, I suppose. But there was some Brexit in the script. There were some Brexit references, and which carries on my tradition of only accepting work now that has Brexit related in some way. So yes.
So looking forward to Last Brexmas coming out soon. We're also joined by Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, and a man who tweeted his fingers to the bone yesterday. Hi, Ian.
Hey.
So was your tweet that the Independent Group needed to start meeting somewhere less establishmenty, because you were a wordsmith, the reason that they all went to Nando's immediately afterwards, and are you to blame for Anna Soubry's "I wanted to go to Pizza Express" sad face?
I thought that the Nando's shot was definitely an improvement, right? And at least we get to at least half of my colleagues in the lobby spent most of that day just assessing what everyone was eating. One person, I can't remember who, went for salad and chips, which is an amazing...
Soubry.
That she is didn't an want to be amazing there. Combo.
That was a pass-ag order. But then Heidi, I'm a vegetarian, I'm no Nando's expert, but Heidi Allen seemed to be winning the table there.
Yeah, well, she seems visibly ecstatic at all times now. She seems like someone that's been set free from a dungeon somewhere. She's just like, "Hello birds, hello trees," off we go. It's quite impressive. Nando's is obviously criminally overrated, but nevertheless, at least it was a better look for them.
Mm. Yeah. But I do think, apart from all the political analysis of TIG, on a human level, there is that feeling that you might have if you get out of a bad relationship or you leave a job after too long, where there's just this kind of I don't have to put up with this shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, they all have that vibe, but Heidi Allen most of all. It's just fuck this, school's out, motherfuckers. Which I find immensely heartwarming. Let's say hello to our special guests. Claire Hannah is the MLA for South Belfast. Her background is in education and development. And on Twitter, she lists her interests as art, sustainability and remaining. Hello, Claire. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Lovely to be here.
During the response to May's statement yesterday, the backstop came up a lot, but there was only one Irish accent heard, and it was Nigel Dodds of the DUP saying he wants a legally watertight way out of it. Is the rest of Britain getting a sort of proper idea of what people in Northern Ireland think of the backstop? Or do you think that that sort of voice is underrepresented.
Yeah, no, they're definitely not. The DUP speak for about a third of the electorate. Our relationship with democracy is so unhealthy that only half of our MPs take their seats. So they're misrepresenting us and the other half are probably not representing us at all. But in fairness, it has fairly broad-based support. Like Remain, a majority of people supported Remain and that went across the communities, you know, unionist, nationalist, and it seems to be fairly watertight for the backstop. Most people get that it's an insurance policy.
And do you think that sort of that on the mainland, this having fundamentally ignored Northern Ireland during the referendum campaign, that it sort of finally got through, that the word backstop has been used more times than ever in human history?
Absolutely.
And the message got through.
Well, look, I think what has definitely happened, even people who weren't completely sold on it, all of the twists and turns and the changed policies and the reverse promises has underlined the need for it. People were going, if we didn't trust you at the start of it, we definitely don't trust you now. So we need it more than ever. But yeah, I think the penny has dropped for a lot of people. That, I mean, the technical issue that if any part of the island is outside of the single market, but I think it's dawning on people the impact it's having in terms of the Good Friday Agreement and on identity and peace and all that. But the penny hasn't dropped, unfortunately, with the DUP, who are the ones that have the big loud voice in Westminster.
We'll talk more about that later. Completing the panel today, Paul Frisvold, trade, energy and climate commentator from Norway, one-time leader of the European movement in Norway, former Olympic fencer, just showing off now, and the author of Towards Europe, the story of a reluctant Norway, where, as he says, the dark corners of the EEA Norwegian model are described in some detail. Hi, Paul. Thanks for coming. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Norway has a sort of famously arm's length relationship with the EU. Do you think that Norway has a different view of Brexit and Britain's situation than, for example, members of the EU27? Or is it just similarly like the Danish actor in Last Christmas?
It's very similar. You have to recall that you've had one referendum, at least in modern times. We've had two. And we've hadn't had an uncivil war. We've had cold civil wars.
Right.
So, as you say, when I became leader of the European movement, my aunt told me, Paul, did you have to do that? Why did you have to do that? Because nobody wants that discussion again. And that's what this Norwegian model is. If it's good for something, it's good for that. That it allows us to, in some ways, forget about the whole thing.
Is it as toxic, the discussion, as it is here?
Oh, absolutely. It splits families, work colleagues, friendships. It's really, really very difficult. It's something that goes across every... I don't think there's one political party that has more than 60% of either side. Mm. It splits all kinds of assembly of people. Mm.
Oh, and I suppose you haven't actually had a civil breakdown yet, so that's quite promising. Well, you've been living. Well, because I think everyone's just like, we're divided. There's this new divide, and everyone's a bit panicky and just like, will we ever come back together?
Yeah.
You know, as perhaps slightly sort of hysterical tone to that.
Yeah. But no, we had it was lying there in the bottom. Yeah. So when we had our last referendum with these horrible, horrible conflicts and confrontations, it was there. So we knew that. If we lost, we would win every day from now on, as we said. Mm. Whereas those who won, they have lost every day because we have become increasingly, systematically, continuously integrated into the internal market as it has evolved. But we're still not a member.
I was told by this Norwegian politician once, where he sort of said, we kind of wish you guys would stop talking about this because it keeps on dredging up all of this old shit that we kind of felt like we'd put in the drawer. Is that like a feeling that the political class have over there? Like, we're unhelpful.
We're very scared. And we see it already on the opinion polls. The no parties are now starting to rise and to get more and more like our agrarian party. They only live for this issue. Mm-hmm. And now they're up on 20, on 15 points again.
As a result of Brexit?
It's the fact that these issues are surfacing.
Does the agrarian party have like a kind of rural Nigel Farage then?
Yes, absolutely. Oh. Very similar. Very similar. They're just categorically...
Does he have a name?
Is there a person? Yeah, the funny thing is his name in Norwegian is Battle, Slagvoll. So it's a battle of violence, and that's
my lord, I
should be a bit on the nose. I think in the next draft we'll change his name. We'll get into all those issues after this quick reminder from Ingrid.
There might be only 29 days to Brexit, allegedly, but there's a healthy 37 days until Remainiacs takes the stage at the podcast Live Politics Day in Euston, London. Dorian plus regulars Naomi Smith, Alex Andreu and Nina Schick will be live on Sunday the 7th of April as part of a festival of politics podcasts, including Ian Dale and Jackie Smith's For the Many, Red Box from The Times, Samira Ahmed's How I Found My Voice, and, if you like that kind of thing, James Dellingpole's Delling Pod. Something for everyone. It's happening at The Light opposite Euston Station, and tickets are on sale now at podcastlive.com. Of course, our Patreon supporters get a discount, of course they do, on day tickets, as well as tickets to the Remainiacs show. Check your Patreon inbox for the code. And if you're not backing us on Patreon yet, why the hell not? You'll get join now, basically. You'll get discounts on live tickets, our covetable merchandise, including our new smash hit. 17.4 million people voted for this turd coffee mug, commemorating Dr. Philip Lee's contretemps with Telegraph columnist Camilla Tominey. Try saying that when you've had a few. And if you're on the $5 tier or upwards, our new monthly Ask Remainiacs show, we're recording part two right after the show, and it will be with you at the weekend. Search Patreon Remainiacs or go to our Facebook page to find out more.
And at the end of the day, we'll have a battle royale with Delling Pod. Before we get started, let's remember that it's not the TIG, it's TIG. They're not the independence group or the TIG group. It's like pin number. We've had a lot of tweets about this. It's a very sensitive issue. Anyway, there's only two stories this week, and they're big ones. The latest Theresa May hem and Labour coming out for a people's vote, possibly. Let's start with the government. Theresa May finally accepted the inevitable on Tuesday and conceded that if her amended withdrawal agreement falls on March the 12th, there will be a vote to explicitly rule no deal in or out the next day. And if they do rule out no deal, there will be a vote on March the 14th for a short extension of Article 50. Laura Kinsberg says March 12th, 14th will be some of the most important days of the whole process. And history fans, the Ides of March falls on March 15th. So someone will die. Ian, you've been expecting this for a while. There's been enormous pressure on May to accept this, including from cabinet members Greg Clark, Amber Rudd and David Gawk.
Latter.
I don't know.
Latter. Well, I always say the latter, but then I mispronounce all sorts of shit. So.
Let's go with Gawk. How much of a sort of game changer is it?
I think it is a game changer, but not necessarily the way that it looks. I mean, it looks, this whole week has looked like Remainers have the wind in their sails, like the independence group sort of coming out has forced both parties to go into another direction. Now, when you just take a step back from it, I think things are not looking that great. And I was quite down about what happened yesterday, mostly because I don't see MPs recognising the trap, the danger that's in front of them. She wants to extend, she says, a short extension. We're expecting that to be 2 months, maybe 3 months, which was the kind of thing that was being floated by the Labour leadership when they were talking of supporting the Cooper Amendment that was going to basically do the same thing. Now, as May confirmed yesterday in the Commons, that all works fine as long as you're out on July the 1st. On July 2nd, the new European Parliament takes its seats. Now, if we have not taken part in European parliamentary elections before that point, we are going to have to leave. There are some people that say maybe there's some sort of solution, but very, very few. The overwhelming majority of the opinions of what is being said in Europe is that we would have to leave unless we've been part of those elections, because there is a chance, a risk, not 100%, different lawyers have different views on it, that the parliament would be illegally constituted. And if it was illegally constituted, any decision that it made, including the selection of the commissioners, would therefore be challengeable in the European Court of Justice, and they're not willing to take that risk because it would be like almost Brexit contaminating the whole European system, bringing everything into uncertainty. Then it's not enough then to just say that we have to take part in those elections in late May. We really need to have passed the legislation domestically to take part, I would say basically by May 1st, basically late April. If we do not, once we get past that point of passing the legislation and up until July, we're in the dead zone. Like, there is no more extension that is going to be available to us. And my strong suspicion is that May's plan is to do this, you extend a little bit further till July, whatever, at the very latest, July 1st, at the very latest, and then you do exactly the same fucking shit that she has been doing for this entire period, which is to say, here is my deal and there is no deal. Which one of these do you prefer? Except that this time, any option available to critics of Brexit, to moderates, to Remainers, to soft Brexiters, whatever, would no longer be present. Now, that seems to me to be the trap. And I didn't see any MP raise any questions about what was going on with the elections yesterday. And that really, really troubles me.
And do you think that this was a move that she was planning already? Would it, when we're going to get to the effect of defections from Labour to TIG, do you think that Soubry, Allen and Wollaston leaving had anything to do with it? Or has exerted any pressure?
Yeah, well, and also the people in Cabinet, the members of Cabinet, like Amber Rudd, sort of threatening they're going to vote for the Cooper Amendment. But ultimately, she knew she was going to have to do this at some point anyway. The piece of legislation that she wants to do, basically the piece that puts the deal into domestic legislation to pass on our books, is a fucking massive piece of legislation, country-defining piece of legislation. You're not just going to suddenly shove it through. You've got hundreds of statutory instruments that you'd need online by the time we do this. They haven't even published the one on fucking tariffs yet. Tariff now is just like an after. Oh, who cares about tariffs, right? Why does that matter? Maybe we can just shuttle that through the Commons.
I know somebody who cares about tariffs.
Right here. Fortunately, he's not an MP and cannot scrutinise statutory instruments. So all of that is a major issue. So she was almost, even if she got her deal, she was going to have to extend. If they had decided to go for no deal, I think they would have extended as well, because you can't get rid of the things that are going to hit you, but you can use those 2-3 months at least to hire some more customs officials, at least to try and put something in place in terms of the clearance systems, all of that that you would need to have going. So everyone knew at some point we would extend. And we've been, you know, most people in sort of the sort of Brexit commentariat-y bubble have pretty much gone, this is a technical certainty. The only question is when it becomes a political reality that someone feels they can say it. Now it's been said. But I have to say, you know, it's so funny that after this whole period of thinking we're going to have to extend at some point, the fact that when the Prime Minister comes to the Commons and says we probably are going to have to extend, which is ultimately what she said, it was kind of ironic that it was actually a really depressing spectacle, because it was quite clearly part of a plan that people didn't seem to see the danger in front of them.
Ingrid, how do you think this affects... Maze.
Ingrid,
you
with
like
the
it.
Thumbs
like
up it. Sign, yeah. Full
thumbs
of joy.
Up.
Or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
How does this affect sort of May's standing in the eyes of the electorate? Does she look like, at least she seems to be, dangers, you know, notwithstanding, seems to be acknowledging reality for a brief moment?
Yeah, I don't know that in the eyes of the electorate, I wish...
You are the electorate,
I am the electorate, and I wish that, I mean, we all are, apart from you, Paul. but I wish that in... I wish that people did care, and I wish that people knew what was going on. But, you know, when you see polls where people think we've already left, I don't think people will go, oh, 3 months extension, that's a massive big deal. I don't think that's how people's brains work. And it isn't, as Ian has just pointed out, it's not a big deal, really, substantively. As in, it just... It kicks the can further down the road. But you know, Ian, it's that thing, isn't it, of... Well, how much longer do we... I know what you're saying about the European elections, but then do we extend for 6 months or a year? At some point, we have to resolve it. So what to do?
I mean, I guess my hope would be that... Well, two things could happen, right? Either you have the amendment to Home, so right now there's an amendment by Spelman, which has some chance, by the time that you'll be listening to this, you'll know whether it's passed or not, which says, well, let's have some kind of indicative votes in the Commons to try and figure out what the fuck it might be that we're going to do. Or you get something from the European side, and this at the moment, I'd say, is my major hope, which is a depressing thing, is for them to go, look, no, we're not doing the fucking 3 month thing, because we're not going to keep on just... Unless you've got an idea, that doesn't solve anything.
Yeah.
So we will give you until the end of the year, or we'll give you 12 months, or some people are even talking about 21 months, and you will take part in those elections, and we will restart this process and actually have a different kind of conversation.
There was a post, I think Guy Verhofstadt just put on his Facebook page, that he is not keen for a 21-month extension, because he's like, we've had enough of this shit. Mm. Like, the idea of them, for them, of dealing with this for another 21 months, even if the will was here to do that, I don't know that the will...
But Verhofstadt ultimately is just he's a sort of loudmouth parliament guy. Whereas, I mean, when you look at sort of Tusk, who really matters, like, he's much more sympathetic to those sort of ideas. But definitely, they're totally split on that themselves. Like, loads of them don't like the idea of it going on that long.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't. So, and that's the most... that's the most important thing.
Ingrid, had enough. Paul, I know they talk of nothing else in the fjords of Norway, but just this whole process since June 2016, from an outsider's point of view, what effect has it had on your impression of Britain's ability to govern itself, make decisions, be grown-ups?
I tell you, we've learned so much about Great Britain, United Kingdom, your political structure, parties, the House of Commons, how it works, it is a fantastic entertainment because it doesn't really affect us emotionally. So we only get the pleasure part. So, you know, it's been heydays for social media and political nerds like me. But I can imagine that it must be a different feeling for you guys.
God, it's like you've invited over all your coolest friends when your uncle shits himself. Yeah. So suddenly they're watching.
But we had a small debate in the sense that what are we going to do if they want to join us? Oh my God. We're going to come into our little club. You know, our little exclusive club where we are the big elephant in the room.
Can you imagine just like you've got this little club and then you watch 3 years of somebody just like blundering about, trousers falling down, throwing up. Yeah. And then at the end of 3 years, like banging on the door going, hello!
Exactly.
Trying to chat you up.
Exactly. And this schizophrenia in the government where they've said, well, we cannot say no. I mean, we can't. I mean, they're our best friends. I mean, our royal house came from the British. I mean, you defended us during the war.
We give you the Christmas tree.
I mean, you are our most important ally in Europe, if not in the world. So how could we? Nevertheless, we don't want you. You're too big.
Don't take the Christmas tree back. Okay. At least leave us there.
No. That's permanent.
So we're going to try and do a little bit of a kind of indent flowchart here of all the possibilities.
What the fuck is an indent flowchart?
It's you basically exploring the multiverse.
Oh, shit. Okay. Because
we're going to start with... So May's deal... how likely is it? Is there any chance that it won't fall on March the 12th? Are there enough people coming around to it?
There's a chance. So Jacob Rees-Mogg was sounding... It was basically U-turning fucking hard on everything he said for the last few months, but apparently with nobody noticing it, when he suddenly said, oh, maybe you don't need to break open the withdrawal agreement. Maybe we can just do it by some kind of legal bridge, the codicil, which would be in the future relationship document. That's a major change from him, a massive change. You don't see the DUP saying that. The DUP, Nigel Dodds, when he stands up, at least at the moment, is still saying you need to make changes in the withdrawal agreement rather than in the future relationship text. There is a chance, let's say 15%, of May's deal passing in some way. I suspect that actually what she did yesterday of raising the prospect of extension means that it's less likely to pass, because I think lots of the ERG types would just think, fuck it, we can afford to vote against it now. There's a little bit more time to prepare for no deal. We know that there's this big hard brick wall on the other side of that thing in 3 months' time. So, I mean, I would not expect it to pass, and if I was a gambling man, I would vote strongly against it passing, but there is a glimmer of a chance.
Claire, the Brexiters keep bringing up the idea of an amended backstop. Do you think? I mean, can it be amended? What can be done with it? What are the alternative arrangements?
It can't. I mean, obviously, it was in terms of making it UK wide, albeit that's better for Ireland north and south. You can't. I mean, I'm very clear. A barrier east west isn't ideal. We don't want any barriers to trade and movement between Northern Ireland and Britain. But it's disingenuous to say, as the DUP do, that it's intolerable down the Irish Sea, but it's perfectly manageable across the island, which is effectively what the. So, no, there aren't. I mean, alternative arrangements is bunkum. We know that, you know, they've got nothing, or else they would be prepared to go forward with alternative arrangements and they would have produced them. But, I mean, it is literally impossible to do. You can't track a punnet of strawberries, you know, crossing any one of dozens of points. It does literally bisect schools and churches and homes, you know, where the front of your house is in the north and in the south. So there's no way of doing it with technology. But it is important to say it's not about managing the line A to B. The tragic part about it is all of the stuff that it's shoved back into politics. The Good Friday Agreement was about not having to talk about the border and sovereignty and whether you're British or Irish. And this just means now we're talking about literally nothing else, morning, noon and night on the radio. And that's what's dramatically upset Northern Ireland.
Have you not been reassured by Julia Hartley Brewer's skiing holiday?
Well, she gets
in which
it.
She seems to be between France and Switzerland. No bother.
Absolutely. We're going to ski.
Could you not just ski?
Ski from Newry to Dundalk, as anybody will tell you. The coolie.
With a rucksack full of strawberries.
Absolutely. With all your family on your back. Yeah. It's not possible, and they know it, and they show things like the, you know, the toll booth, which is nothing to do with the border, and photographs of this. But, you know, it's It's simply not possible, even if it were just crossing the line and literally, you know, 30,000-40,000 people cross the border every single day for their work. A lot of us live a north-south existence, but for people in those border communities who maybe, you know, go there to get your pint of milk and over there for your doctor's appointment, it's not possible in any way, shape or form.
Back to the don't flowchart. If the May deal falls, and then there's the no deal vote on March the 13th.
Yeah, next day. Yeah. Should definitely be defeated.
Right.
Because, no, I mean, that's definitely... I mean, there's, yeah, really, I mean, like, there's very few things that are more
I mean, how many people would even vote for...
I would say probably you'd probably have about 70 MPs. Basically, you'd have the ERG lot. You know, on a good day, you'd have 70 of them, 50 to 70 people. They're a bunch of fucking millennialist lunatics, and they'll fucking do it. So, but it doesn't matter. I mean, that would definitely fail.
When you say fail, just to clarify, sorry.
Sorry, that means... Because the proposition would be, shall we leave with no deal?
Yes.
And so it'll fail and we will not be leaving with no deal.
Yes, thank you.
And then the next day, so March 14th, you then have, do you want to extend? What's odd to me is today, sort of Cooper Bowles put forward their new amendment, which was basically mimicking, in a frankly sort of sub-tweety sort of way, it was just this kind of fuck you, basically just quoting what May had said when she took on their amendment and putting it back to her. It's basically an attempt to humiliate her, I think, of just going, oh, well, why would you not whip your MPs to pass this, given that it's your policy? But there does seem to me to be one distinction, which was that the mechanism for deciding the length of the extension under Cooper Bowles was up to MPs. Under the May deal, it was up to the government. Now, I think in terms of what it would be, there's probably very little difference. I think MPs only have the appetite for about 3 months anyway. But that still is a major difference to me, that the government decides rather than MPs deciding how long the length would be. But regardless, they'll put that down. I think MPs will vote for that, probably. There is the nightmare scenario, by the way. This is the MPs don't vote for either of these fucking things. Go like, don't like no deal, don't ever, and off they go. But yeah.
Well, I mean, what would happen in that scenario if they literally rejected every option?
I think it would be revoke or no deal.
But they've just rejected no deal.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because ultimately they're just voting on a motion, whereas no deal happens by, you know, we should have David Allen Green should drop down from the sky. automatic operation of the law. And that would be how that would operate. Or the government could just revoke. I mean, it seems probably you would need some kind of parliamentary support according to the Gina Miller case, but we know that the government can just revoke if it wants to. So one of those two things would happen. Probably I would suggest it would probably be no deal.
Would they be able to? Would May be able to take the deal back again? Going, well, now that we know we're definitely not having an extension, vote again. Otherwise, it is no deal. Then people would have to presume.
Yeah, she might well give it a go. But ultimately, I do expect MPs to vote for a short extension of Article 3. I think that's what will happen.
I think the problem was it came at the same time as Labour's move, and it's hard to keep the hope battened down. But you've done a really good job.
Thank you. I'm here to bring despair wherever it's possible. It's a, you know.
Are there any more amendments we should be aware of?
There is the Costa Amendment, which has caused a spasm of fucking chaos in the government of, you know, Costa himself having to resign so he could bring forward an amendment which the government is now supporting but wasn't supporting
yesterday. Who's Costa? Can we explain who Costa is?
He's a Tory MP. Italian father, but, you know, but basically has kept his sort of, isn't particularly associated with Remain or Brexit in that sort of way. This amendment would basically say to the government, you've got to take out the citizens' rights bits. We want you to try and negotiate something separate with the EU there in the event of no deal, or to at least just carve this part out and work on it so we can guarantee it at home and try and guarantee it for Brits in Europe. Now, we broke this actually last week. Everyone's talking about it now. We broke it on the podcast last week. It looks like that's going to pass. You may have noticed Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary, was in front of a Commons Select Committee still thinking that the government supported it when he was informed that the government no longer supported it. And when he asked, well, who says that? And they were like, the Prime Minister. And there's a beautiful moment where for 1 second you can see his eyes just start to blow out of his face. And he's like, oh, well, well. And he's furiously backtracking. The government is now supporting it again. So it looks like it's going to pass. That is a good, solid amendment on a moral level, on a strategic level, on a political level. And there's a one little ray of sunshine that we can introduce to the discussion.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn pulled his own reverse ferret on Monday when it was announced that Labour would back a people's vote if it failed to get its version of Brexit passed this week. Tom Watson and Keir Starmer seem to have finally got Corbyn over the line, aided by the spectre of more defections to TIG. Within hours, the question arose of whether a Labour people's vote would be a straight choice between May and Remain, or a three-way vote, or if Remain would even be on the ballot. A mysterious senior Labour source said a choice between May's deal and Remain would not be acceptable. Ian, do you have any ideas who this person might be?
Fuck knows. And, well, who could imagine?
And whether his father has ever led the BBC?
We have a bit of a... There's a bit of an issue with stuff at the moment because... Well, it's not at the moment. I mean, the trouble is lobby rules, isn't it? Lobby rules basically say you can't name the spokesman. And that worked when parties were coherent units. But now that they're these warring tribes, when he comes out to say that, he is not representing the Labour view. He is representing a bit within Labour. So it's sort of, to give the reader any clear indication of what is going on, you should name him. But you cannot name him by lobby rules. And that is a bit of an issue. It's about the system based in a way that isn't working. And I would do the same thing, by the way. I mean, I'm in the lobby, so if the information was given to me in that context, I wouldn't name him either. The journalists are not at fault. The rules are starting to feel quite old.
So Emily Thornberry and Tom Watson immediately slapped down Spokesman X. Alex Sobel said whoever Spokesman X was should be sacked. Ben Bradshaw wading in. Has Spokesman X overplayed his hand at last? Has the sort of the power shifted? Because I think you made the point. I mean, you've made the point often. I think a lot of people still don't get this. Is that when you're trying to understand Labour's position, you have to understand the factions within Labour, and that Labour's position is whoever sort of seems to have the upper hand at that point.
Yes, and so they're slipping back. You can see that Starmer, with weird ally McDonnell, and lots of the people at their backs who have stuck by Corbyn while maintaining their anti-Brexit stance, so people like David Lammy or Clive Lewis, people that have done the opposite of the independent group guys. I mean, the victory is part of that. It's sort of like, it's the let's cover the tent in piss theory. You know what I mean? Like, you piss from inside, you piss from outside, and then just generally by the end of it, you might shake out in a better political position. On that basis, they've managed to shift it. However, look at their rear guard defence. Because their rear guard defence, they had an opening salvo with that. Oh, it doesn't need to be Remain versus May's deal. That fell apart. They didn't manage to sustain it. Now it seems to be, well, it's a vote on May's deal if it passes, which makes it almost completely redundant. Because by the time May's deal passes, no one gives a fuck about having another referendum. Mm. It's only as an escape valve from the fact that there's no exit point to get to. So that's where they are now. However, when people despair about this stuff, I think they've got the wrong idea. It's about shifting them in incremental units to a time frame. We're not great on the time frame, but they are shifting. And this was still a positive development to my mind.
Ingrid, it was quite, I'm not sure if you're on Twitter at the time when this news broke, but it was quite a thrill ride. How many emotions did you go through from like yay to oh?
I wasn't on Twitter when it broke. Was it my birthday? I think it was my birthday. It was like a little gift to me. So I wasn't on Twitter, and that was a lesson, because that taught me you don't have to be along for every single element of the thrill ride, because it's exhausting. Just come to it 24 hours later when it's all settled down a bit, and then you can make an informed decision. But I was, to be honest, I've decided to be more positive. That's my new mantra. So yay. And I think that everyone that's been doing the work behind the scenes, including Naomi and people who have been sort of pushing Labour towards this position for so long, great. I was slightly underwhelmed, because it feels like they've been sort of skirting around it for ages. It's always been on the table. So, as Ian said, it's not saying we're tabling this. It's saying if May's deal passes, we want a referendum, which, as Ian also says, is sort of unlikely. But actually though, if they do get that through, and there is, and the government agrees to a second referendum, if May deal passes, that surely will help the deal pass, will it not? Because then if people can then go, actually, now we'll agree to it, but we're putting it back to the people. So that feels like quite a sensible thing to do.
Creating the conditions where when things get more hectic later on, that is a possible avenue of making things work. It is more positive than some people are suggesting.
What do you make of the argument, Ingrid, that the Lisa Nandy argument that not having no deal on the ballot paper would be democratically illegitimate, and that you should, if people want to shoot themselves in the face, you should give them that opportunity?
Absolutely not. I cannot stress enough how angry I would be. Well, not that. And I imagine they care a lot, the government, how angry Ingrid Oliver is. Is that you cannot have no deal you cannot have it on the ballot. Because if you're saying the government would be prepared to take us out of the EU on no deal, to do that to our country, then we've lost our fucking minds. And so I don't care if it's democratic. You can't put something on a ballot that you wouldn't be prepared to deliver.
You might as well just put on it and burn it all down.
To deliver no deal, then I don't know who we are anymore. I really don't. So, no. Basically,
I think the problem is we've already lost our minds. You know, it's already it's already out there. I agree with you. I think it's disastrous, but it's going to be very difficult. The betrayal narrative is already being seeded, and whatever we get, you know, the Brexiters will ride that for the next number of years. So it's if it's seen as what did Farage say, he'd just go on holiday, possibly skiing. I don't know if we can get away without a very Leavey punch yourself in the face option for people who want to take it.
Like you said, Northern Ireland is very Remain-y. Does that extend to enthusiasm for a people's vote?
It's fair to say, I mean, it was 56% Remain. It should have been a lot Remainier, given that we are overwhelmingly a net beneficiary in terms of, you know, all sorts of structural and peace funds, as well as the fact that we're screwed without it trade-wise. Yeah, I think there's good support for a people's vote among almost all the parties except the DUP, and I think even some of them realise it's what gets them off the hook, because if there's a bad Brexit, the carnival of reaction that follows will lead to a border poll, enormous division, very very possibly Irish unity, but certainly upheaval and damage and chaos, including for the DUP. So I think so. I think we had the same very weak, limited campaigning and debate as you had here, where we all shouted statistics at each other rather than actually trying to sell the merits of the idea. But I think almost all parties except the DUP have expressed support for it in some strength or another.
Paul, Labour's sort of Brexit vacillations have been driving us nuts for months. What do you make of there are people who argue, you know, that this was all just, they've just been playing this long game and this was always where it was leading. What do you make of the way that Corbyn and his crew have played this?
Well, you know, I think that his battle is really the battle of Britain that you have, because his party is as divided as the rest of the population, I assume. So I think it's about avoidance of pain. So what is the least painful solution? And you know, his last thing, that he wants a new referendum, that's very painful, and he knows that that's not going to go through. So then, a vassal state, Norway plus, suddenly becomes a much more valuable option.
Vassal, like backstop, vassal. Is a word that we've been hearing a lot more of recently. Ian, this has enraged Labour MPs in Leave seats. John Mann told Corbyn, "The prize will stop you being Prime Minister because that's literally the only obstacle." could Labour get the argument that maybe he was saying is like, okay, everyone's waiting for kind of Corbyn to support this idea, but even if he did, you'd have people like John Mann and Caroline Flint and Gloria De Piera and so on who would block it. So do you think that there would be the votes?
No, there definitely isn't the votes. It's a necessary but insufficient condition. But just because there isn't the votes, people are so weirdly split. Half the people pretend if only Jeremy Corbyn pressed the switch and authorised people's vote, it would automatically happen and everything would be fine. Mm. The other half act like just because the votes aren't there right now, it's impossible that it will ever take place. And you just think both of those seem to be quite simplistic, really. We don't have the votes right now. So I would say between, let's say, 50 to 70 Labour MPs are going to vote against. I would say, let's say 50. Okay, 50 seems about right to me. I do think you'd have that many that would vote against the whip on it. When you look at, for instance, how they haven't voted for really quite moderate propositions, like let's extend Article 50 a bit, you know, on that basis, I think that they would vote against. Then you've got to get those votes from the Tory benches. Now, at the moment, they're not there. There's probably only about 9 to 12 Tory MPs who would vote this way. However, as things get tenser and tenser and tenser, that seems more possible. You need to just demonstrate proof of concept that you only need another 50 votes to get it, that there is a big amount of common support, given how little support there is for other options. And then as things get tighter, there's a chance for it to happen. But right now, the numbers are not there.
And a big question that was coming up when this was announced was how much of it was related to TIG. I've had Corbynites insisting to me this is just the procedure laid out at conference. There's nothing whatsoever to do with Labour losing 8 MPs to a new group whose signature policy is a people's vote. It's just a coinky dink. Yeah. Is it just a coinky dink?
No, that's so fucking. And you know that constant thing of you can just see them gearing up with the tribal ideal and going, well, this is, you know, nothing has changed. This is always where you just think, like, honestly, if you're fooling yourself, then, you know, take yourself off for some kind of medical checkup. But don't try and pretend that I need to go through the same shit myself. It is perfectly obvious that when it comes to what's going on in the Tory party, when it comes to what's going on in Labour, this is about the independent group. Now, them doing this has, you know, arguably done very little for their own prospects. We don't know how things will shake out. At the moment, they look fairly lonely as things start to shift another way. However, I would say in terms of concrete political effects in a very short time period, it's been about 10 days so far since they first did something, they're one of the most efficient political entities that this country's ever known. So full credit to them.
It's such a strange thing, though, isn't it? Because I think Kevin Maguire and some other people, from Kevin Maguire from The Mirror, was going, oh, this is, you know, this is bad news for Tig, because this was their kind of big policy and now it's been taken away. But surely the reason that they left their parties was because they cared so much about this. And so the fact that it seems to be getting closer, like you said, by no means over the line, I mean, it doesn't seem like a kind of an abject failure. And it doesn't seem like they must have known that this policy would only succeed if it was supported. So right, it doesn't seem as if they hadn't thought this through.
And let's not pretend that it's just about this either. I mean, right now, you know, as we speak, Chris Williamson's out there saying the most horrific, venomous, toxic shit I could ever imagine and still got the fucking whip. Mm-hmm. You know, this is about something much more poisonous. And for those guys, you could take Brexit away as a whole and they would still, I think, be in the position that they're in right now.
Can I ask, sorry, in terms of Tig, they've said that they're going to schedule an amendment about a second referendum, haven't they? Have they not come out and said that?
They have, but you'd imagine that wouldn't get support. I think Labour will whip against it, probably.
So that's
it won't do the proof of concept thing that we need.
Right.
They're going to want
it to come from inside of Labour. So the Carl amendment, which is from a Labour MP, which was different. It was to say that we would support the deal if you hold another referendum. I think the leadership's going to want to rejig that so it, if the deal passes, we'll give another one. They're going to basically try to take away its force. I don't think they'll be taking something from the Tigs.
Yeah.
You've also, of course, there is this big debate within the People's Vote organisation and the MPs that support them about, do you start putting forward votes that start to show a certain level of support and stay in the conversation, or do you try to hold back so that you'll never seem to be losing it? I always was instinctively with the former on that. I have to say, I do understand the organisation's point of view when you look at the way that the Cooper, Naomi raised this on the show once, when you look at the way the Cooper amendment was defeated and then the next day, even though it was by like 20 votes or something, the next day everyone's like, well, that's just fucking dead. There's no way that'll ever come back. Let's talk more about Theresa May's reform deal, which was only defeated by 200, you know, whatever. Yeah. So you think that it's clear that because the guns are out in that way, there is some sensible strategy there, but that is a swirling debate even now.
Still, worth celebrating with a moderately sized Nando's. We promised you some Irish border explanation, and by God, we've got it. Claire Hannah is the MLA for South Belfast. Claire, we've talked about the border, we've talked about the backstop, but perhaps not in enough detail. It seems simultaneously very simple and maddeningly complex, because you can't have Brexit without a hardish border, and you can't have a hard border and keep the Good Friday Agreement. And you were saying earlier that kind of is how it stands. There isn't some sort of magic solution. So watching people discuss magic solutions month after month, mm-hmm. Did you just feel like sort of Groundhog Day, that you're not getting any closer, because that is just the hard fact?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've spoken about it in the programme before, that there's no, you know, facts don't exist. You have to build up each argument. And I certainly was making exactly these points well in advance of the referendum, that it's, you know, if either part is outside of the single market and the customs union, the line has to be drawn somewhere, and all of the other impacts. So, yes, it feels like you're explaining the same thing, and it hasn't been accepted, and people are proposing alternative arrangements that aren't unicorns, they're horses in unicorn costumes and everything. They're not even the decency of a unicorn. But yep, it feels like that penny hasn't dropped. But as I say, it's the wider non-trade impacts that are probably more discombobulating. I mean, as you know, we don't have an assembly. There's no prospect, even those of us who think all of the other problems are solvable yesterday, there's no prospect whatsoever of Stormont being re-established until Brexit is discharged in whatever way it has to be hopefully solved. But
because I think it's quite hard for people who don't live there to understand what it means that there is no assembly.
Well, I mean,
there's sort of no good, but like, what What effect does that have?
Yeah, I mean, we've got it. I mean, obviously, like, you know, things still run, but you're in kind of cut and paste from month to month. There's no innovation. A lot of decisions, whether it's will that school get its new build or whatever, they all rack up and rack up. Obviously, everybody blames everything on it. The things that you want to do, well, I can't because there's no government. And unfortunately, we have neatly cut out the blame. Half of the people will blame the DUP for it. Half of the people will blame Sinn Féin for it when they're both equally intransigent and ridiculous. But it's this perception that the place is ungovernable, but ultimately somebody is running it. It's the civil service. It's just that there's no accountability and no political oversight, or what's worse, in terms of the direct rule that we're kind of having from London, it has no balance. It's only really the DUP who are able to look in over the Secretary of State's shoulder and kind of nudge her in certain directions. And that's fundamentally incompatible with the Good Friday Agreement, which should be about, you know, all sections of the community being represented in governance. I know that sounds really dry, but it's just it's basically crucial. we had 20 years of pretty poor governance post Good Friday Agreement, but the show was largely on the road, and this has just taken it completely off the rails.
And when people do, you know, worry about the return of violence, the ERG response is the brilliant, well, it won't happen. And obviously, you don't want to go too far in the direction of kind of of sort of melodrama and Project Fear phrases popped into my head. Mm. You know, you don't want to kind of like, I think it's dirty in the same way that people talking about violence on the streets, if you know, right, if there was another referendum, is dirty. How do you think that those kind of emotions and tensions would manifest themselves?
So there will. It's almost inevitable if there was any infrastructure on the border whatsoever. I mean, if you ever drive, when you come past the signs that say "Welcome to Northern Ireland," there are bullet holes in them. Or if you see on the other side of things, if you see signs with, you know, Irish language, something, they're painted out. We already can't even accept each other's signs a little bit in Northern Ireland. So there would inevitably be, and there are enough nutters who would take a shot at whatever infrastructure is there. Then you have to have security. Then ultimately you have to have troops. So that's how the violence unravels. I don't believe there's any prospect of going back to the Troubles per se, but it is the tension that's created among very ordinary people. And people like me who, for example, I mean, I'm Irish. I'm an Irish nationalist. So I aspire to Irish unity. But if the one thing you've taught us is constitutional change doesn't solve all your problems. So people like me who were content to focus on making Northern Ireland work, on the economy, on reconciliation, Brexit kind of rips that comfort blanket away. You could live with being in the UK when it is, you know, there's no barriers anywhere and it's broadly social democratic, and Brexit taking that out has just massively changed people's perception. So people from kind of the tradition that I represent of sort of moderate, non-violent nationalists who were prepared to give it time now say, what can we do to take Jacob Rees-Mogg's hands off our lives? And that's not limited to people of an Irish or nationalist background. That's people from all shades of the community, and that just inevitably creates uncertainty and tension.
And how do you think things would have been different if May hadn't gambled and lost the 2017 election and ended up relying so much on the DUP? Because the fundamental problem you were talking about would still be there. But how much of a difference has that reliance on the DUP made?
It's clearly made a huge difference because, of course, it isn't just getting the deal through. It's all the other enabling legislation. So she has to keep them on board. And I don't believe for an instant that a lot of the ERG really care about the border or what goes on the island of Ireland. And if you look at some of the ERG papers before the backstop was nailed down, it did talk about some checks in the Irish Sea. They're not bothered about that. And I believe many of them use it as a convenience, and the DUP are a very visible representation of that. So it clearly given the DUP the whip hand, and I suppose that undermined the Good Friday Agreement as well, because in all of the other issues bubbling around language rights and marriage equality and some of the other issues around corruption in Northern Ireland, an independent mediator or the British government would have been able to kind of slap the DUP about a bit and get them on the right track, and they're completely unwilling to do that in this context. So it really changed the dynamic and the atmosphere. Yeah.
And finally, one thing we talk about a lot is about how Britain sees itself and asking these more fundamental questions about kind of the nature of the union and perhaps the fragility of the union. Do you think that one kind of very thin silver lining from this would be the fact that people in the rest of the UK have actually had to think about Northern Ireland and actually perhaps, you know, consider issues that they just haven't thought about.
Well, it's a very Northern Irish thing to kind of assume that everybody's obsessive and knows all the integrity of our quarrel and every twist and turn of it. Well, actually, I think the problem is a lot of the polling will show that Brexiters would be perfectly happy to have that. You know, the average Brexit voter would be quite happy probably to cut off Northern Ireland. And if you think the EU costs you a lot of money, wait till you hear our bill at the end. We clearly are a lot more expensive for the average British taxpayer. So yes, I think it has made people engage with the detail of the difference, but you still have, you know, Priti Patel saying, "Oh, we'll starve them out with a no deal," and things like that. So it's betraying kind of what a lot of particularly conservatives have really thought about us all this time. It's getting it out there. So it doesn't give me any pleasure that suddenly people, you know, have to understand it, because a lot of people in Northern Ireland don't understand it. I certainly, as I say, as somebody who believes that Irish unity is a lot more sensible a project and a prospect, but doesn't want to leave the ordinary Joe trapped in Brexit Britain over here, it doesn't. You know, I think it probably makes more British people want Irish unity than not. And again, that's a massive own goal by the DUP.
Thanks, Claire. Ireland to Norway. If you're still saying Norway Plus, wash your mouth out, because everyone's now calling it, all the kids on the street, skateboarding, listening to hip-hop and grime, are calling it Common Market 2.0 now. Because 2.0 means fresh and modern and computers.
Upgradable. Upgradable.
Keep saying, if there's a Norway Plus, why doesn't Norway want it? You know, if it's so much better than Norway.
Absolutely.
Once a fringe idea, the notion of Britain replicating Norway's deal, but better, for the most painless Brexit possible, has moved more mainstream. It entails EEA membership via EFTA, membership of the single market and a customs union, meaning no border with Ireland, but no membership of the common agricultural or fisheries policies, nor the European Court of Justice. It's backed by the likes of Stephen Kinnock, Nick Bowles, Nicky Morgan, Nicholas Soames, a lot of Nicks, and Oliver Letwin. And it wouldn't require amending the withdrawal bill, only the political declaration. On the downside, Farage, Boris Johnson, Owen Paterson and Dan Hannan have all spoken up for it. So it can't be that good.
Just the point, I've got to say, Daniel Hannan, I think, is more of a Swiss man.
Swiss man?
He's more of a Swiss model kind of guy than the Norway thing. He's a huge in Brexit geek circles. You can imagine the battles those guys
I
have.
Can't believe I mixed those two.
Sorry, guys.
It is a worse deal. Yeah,
absolutely.
Paul Frisvold, our special guest, the title of your book, Towards Europe, The Story of a Reluctant Norway. It's a bit of a spoiler. Norway rejected EU membership in 1994, but was already a member of the EEA. Your own Prime Minister was sort of suspicious of, you know, was a sort of advising Britain, couldn't work out why Britain would like to go for Norway Plus / Common Market 2.0 deal. What do you think would be in it for Britain?
Well, first you said it yourself, the avoidance of pain, that it actually allows you to put this whole debate aside. Because whether the people in the streets of London get their legislation from the City Council, from Westminster or from Brussels, they don't really care as long as it works. Those who cares are those who are involved in politics. And that's why it's a frustrating agreement in Norway, because the people are very, you know, 75% of the Norwegian population is in favor of this agreement. And a similar amount is opposed to membership. And that's that's a contradiction in terms, because we are members of the single market. It's just that we don't have any representation. We have regulation without representation. But it gives us predictability. So it would give the UK society, business, scientists, students, whatever, the predictability that they would need to go on with their daily life. But it would be a huge, I mean, a painful democratic deficit that you've had to cope with.
And what difference would it make to Norway? We're talking about sort of relative sort of clubs. But if this was a kind of similar deal, but not the same, it's not like we'd be wedded to Norway.
No, not at all. I mean,
what difference would it make to Norway?
So that's the interesting part. The two things that are interesting. First of all, the EEA agreement never really took shape. We'll say it's a flexible agreement, But it's an elastic agreement in the sense that we just take on and on more and more legislation. So we could, with Britain on our side, actually make those arrangements that were put in place, because it's not made for small zero countries like Liechtenstein, Iceland and Norway. It was made for Sweden, Finland, Austria, Switzerland, etc. So there is a structure there. And those could be reinvigorated. And I am one of those who claim that we should welcome Britain with open arms. I mean, by all means, poor you. I mean, I wouldn't want you to. It's a catastrophe. But, you know, if that's the only thing you can do,
yeah,
come along. Come along and let's try to make the best out of it. And so that's one thing. The other thing is that I think there is some room of maneuver to make it better. But we would need a whole podcast on that because it's terribly detailed. But there are some amendments that could take place within the existing agreement.
Do you think that would, I mean, Delors right back at the beginning sort of suggested there could be some kind of shared relationship on regulation, which was something that never came to fruition. Do you think anything like that would be possible if there was a sort of weightier global player?
Let's imagine that Theresa May took a totally different stand and went to Brussels and say, you know, let's find a common solution together. And didn't have to think of our backbenches and the tour party and so forth, and would have installed a climate of cooperation, trust, and, you know, because in 1989, when the EEA was born, there was just one puff. It was a euphoria. It was the wall came down, and we're all going to be in the same group, and yada-da-da. But not the Norwegians. They didn't buy into that. But BS.
So, but like my mate who just refused to get into the Stone Roses.
Yeah,
that
well. So, but today it's different. Today there is Macron, the French president, has said we have to accommodate for a multi-speed Europe. So there is an opening there to say, you know, how can we ensure that these countries with democratic difficulties can find themselves within the context of a single market, which is a bit more meaningful than the Norwegian model today.
We had Nick Clegg on the show in 2017 saying that Britain's natural position, sort of psychologically, was in the outer ring of Europe. I mean, is that true of Norway too? Is there something about that was, in a sense, unsurprising about that? About that result, I mean, how do you Norwegians feel European, but not quite?
Yeah, I mean, I just have to disappoint you because there's absolutely no logic. I mean, we are the most open economy, most dependent on trade.
Right.
In fact, statistics tell us that we are the fourth trading country with other European Union members. We had a whole 12. Professors, experts on European relations who wrote a green white paper 5-6 years ago, and even those Eurosceptics one within it, they said, you know, we'd be far better off inside the European Union. But it didn't change anything in the polls. We have it all written that, you know, EU is good for us. We're a small open economy. We depend on trade. Our scientific communities, our students, our pensions. I mean, we're the ones who live on the French Riviera and the Spanish Costa del Sol. We are the ones who benefit from all of these things. But membership is just stuck.
So is there such a thing as Norwegian exceptionalism? Because obviously we think so much about Britain and we go, oh, well, Britain thinks that it shouldn't really be part of Europe because of, you know, because of the war and the empire and just being up itself generally. But, you know, with Norway, is there a reason why culturally, despite all you're saying about trade, the majority of Norwegians just think, yeah, let's just hold back?
Yeah, there are two things. One is the historic aspects. I told you my name is spelled P-A-A-L, Paul, but it's pronounced Paul. It's a Danish version of the O sound because we were under Denmark for 400 years in a union where we were colonized. So, and that has, you know, there was a revolt there. There was 100 years of struggling to gain our independence.
I hear you.
And obviously that, you know.
It doesn't ring any bells.
Just the word union is, you know, is scary to us. The other thing is that, you know, we won the lottery. You know, we have a lot of fish, we have a lot of oil, we have a lot of gas. Mm. Now we even found copper and we are a champion of raw materials. And so we are filthy rich. We are phenomenally rich.
Is that why everything is so incredibly expensive?
That's the other.
Because it's a nightmare when you go.
Well, it's true, but now the krona
really
is very weak. It's very weak.
Interesting.
The krona is very weak, so it's not that expensive, but maybe the pound has fallen too. So it is. But you see, the other reason is that there are more voters who are working in a protected part of the economy. That means either depending on subsidies or a shielded part of the economy, i.e. agriculture and fishery, and defense and health. So as long as all these people, the majority of our electorate, are shielded from the forces of the internal market, they are never going to vote in favor of it.
Mm. Ingrid, if Naomi was here, she would be denouncing supporters of the Norway Plus Kommag 2.0 option as collaborators, quislings, if you will. What do you? But I know that at certain points, when you were thinking, well, you know, kind of maybe. How do you sort of feel about it at this point?
I feel about every time I say what I'm about to say. I feel like Naomi is listening and. I'm going to
be booing
and be angry with me, and I feel bad. But I can only speak for myself. But it's so interesting hearing what you're saying about Norway, because especially that thing about you can present 25 experts and go, this is bad for your country, this is better for your country, and people don't. It doesn't matter. Yeah. And somebody sent me some footage. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's from, I think it's like 60s or 70s. It would have been after the last. When was the last referendum? 1975. 75. It was around that time, and it was sort of man on the street, exactly like they do now in the news footage. Man on the street, but in black and white. Wouldn't have been black and white. Come on, Ingrid, it's the 70s. It was colour. But in my head, it's black and white. And they are all saying the exact same things about Europe that they were saying now, that we're still saying. It's the same people. Yep. So the idea that we're not, the idea that with logic and our logic and our reason, things that seem so obvious to us, isn't getting through. It's quite comforting in a way that we're not mad.
No,
that that's
you're not
just
alone.
The way things are. And actually, what you were saying about us coming into, you know, a Norway agreement where actually we could maybe forge a second speed European Union that's not directly involved in the central part of it, but somewhere on the periphery, might suit us better. So I'm afraid I am still in that let's stay as close as we can to Europe, but we might have to accept that there are lots of people who don't for whatever reason feel that they want to be part of a union.
Finally, Paul, what do you...
Sorry, Naomi. Sorry.
She's saying. What do you think is the most likely conclusion? We're not going to hold you to this because nobody knows. Of the Brexit process, where do you think... Do you think Britain will end up with the sort of arrangement we've been talking about or go to either extreme?
I've written extensively about this in the Norwegian media. In front of the referendum, I always said, you know, the Brits, they will finally make the right decision. And after the debacle over the past 2 years, I'm beginning to doubt. Nevertheless, I see there's very little other alternative. So I see that is a problem for us. If you go for a Common Market 2.0, a EE, Norwegian Plus style, and you get your own agreement, that is going to push us further down the line. That's going to kick us down the lane. Mm. And then we have a problem. And that's why I've been advocating, if, by all means, they should join us, let's welcome them and let's work together. Strengthen the institutions and try to make something better of it, the best that is possible. And I see no other solution. So I think you'll end up in Norway Plus, and we will wish you welcome.
Great.
The problem is the Brexiters will just come back. It creates an actual democratic deficit to replace the imaginary one that they made such hay with. That's my. It doesn't solve it. You know, the whole get it over with, get Brexit over with. It doesn't do that, and they'll just come back and we'll be talking about it for another 20 years.
So we thought that too. It never did. Never did, because it works so well. That's the terrible part.
Yeah, it solves most of the technical problems, certainly.
Maybe we could just ignore the Brexiters.
Yeah. Working on
we
that.
We have to wrap up, and I wanted to ask questions about like article. There's article 102. There's article 111. I had all these questions, and now they're fucking making all these like slashing throat
so
noises.
If,
I've got to stop.
If you should end up with a Norway Plus, then maybe we can do this again.
Great.
And then
great.
We can
yes.
go into details.
Explain what we've signed
this is
up for.
Where you plug your book.
Absolutely.
Everyone looks very relieved. It's not happening right now.
Thanks, Paul. The end of the show is bearing down on us like a non-negotiable deadline. So let's put something else in our Brexit time capsule. As we've got two special guests, two things are going into our repository of stuff we'll need if Brexit ever happens. Claire Hannah, what is going in the box?
I don't want to be totally fatalistic and say the Good Friday Agreement, but it does. Brexit balls is up the whole thing. It's about relationships in Northern Ireland, East-West with Britain and North-South Ireland, and all of those are completely messed up by Brexit. But I'd put Northern Irishness, that was something that was growing. People, you know, you can be not just Irish, but Northern Irish as well. It was a shared identity that meant we didn't have to be hostile, and that was kind of growing over the last 15 years, and Brexit has kind of stopped that, and it was something very positive.
That's really depressing.
Mm. Oh. Sorry.
No, it's all right. It's a really depressing time capsule. I've got to be honest with you.
We don't have to go in there with
from
it.
From
a Brussels point of view, I must say that I think what you're going to miss is an MEP. Because you are going to discover what it is to be on the outside in practical terms. You're going to discover how difficult it will be to push up European issues on your domestic political agenda. And if you don't have people on the inside, then you have few people to play ball with and to be that political voice. So an MEP is, you're going to miss that. And the ability of your MEPs also to participate in that European debate.
Mm-hmm. For this week's European language clip, we've got a joke in German from listener Tom Phillis in Brussels.
Wie viele Engländer braucht man, um eine Glühbirne zu wechseln? Keine. Die ziehen einfach aus dem Haus aus.
This literally translates as, how many Englishmen does it take to change a light bulb? None. They simply move out of the house.
That's very good.
Listeners, we welcome your bits of European language. We're especially up for the deep cuts, Faroese, Romani and Limburgish. Send us a short recording at info@romaniacs.com and we'll use the best ones. That's the end of the show. Thanks to our two guests, Paul Frisvold and Claire Hannah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Ian Ingrid and... Not Ian Ingrid, that's not his name. Thanks to Ian Ingrid and producer Sophie Black, as ever. Is our 100th week a good week? Do we feel more upbeat than usual? I mean, we can't be less upbeat than we were about a month ago when listeners, I think... We're like going, are you okay? This is bringing me down.
That was bad. It's bad.
It was quite
bad.
We've
got lint
it?
Balls, so it's a great week.
It's true. There's some totent of the gifts provided by our producer.
Yeah. After 100 episodes, you get some chocolates. We're back next week for 3 days in March, the ultimate showdown. Until then, here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and our thanks to some of our Patreon backers.
Und viele liebe Grüße from me to Jim Sinstadt, Alessandra McConville, Mark Gill, Michael Parker Bray, Hamish Loveday, Annette Scanlon, Nick Perry, the best dressed man in Stoke Newington, Julia Hayes, Jonathan Palfrey, and Simon Turton.
Hello, and que putas cabrones to Alistair Duncan, Chris White, David Tree, Claire O'Rourke, Paul Barnes, Will Worth, Matthew Pincus, Alison R., Andrew Smith and Kevin Giblin.
And hello from me to Rupert Good, Catherine, possibly Kate Middleton, David Klassen, Nick Powell, Richard Malkin, Jordan Hall, David Dolling, Rosalind Attenborough, Nick Davis and Jack Oliver. Thanks, we'll see you next week.